Hello. This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice. With me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And we come back with highly metaphysical discussions this time about basic things in role-playing games.
It's all about the cloudy window.
It's all about epistemological doubt or something like that. But first, we have...
Well, thank you very much to Brian Parker, who dropped some money in our tip jar.
Oh, we thank you very much. And next, we have a message for the people who are not our sponsors. The nice people at the Bundle of Holding include us in the circulation of free samples for their various offers. And coming up now is a second offer of Good Society. They're doing this because there is going to be a second edition of Good Society, and you'll find a link to that on Bundle of Holding's page. But this is a very interesting game, which I think both Roger and I have mixed feelings about.
It's not so much mixed feelings as I bought this with great intentions. I did actually back their original Kickstarter.
I got the hardback copy and all the cards as well. Don't have them now.
Oh, I don't buy a hard copy. This is possibly why I have slightly more room to swing the cat than you do.
I don't swing my cat. Let me be perfectly clear.
I didn't say I did it. I just have the room to, should I suddenly desire to. Anyway, right. Last time this came up, I think we may have talked about it in that episode. I'll link to it if we did. I probably said something along the lines of, I think this is really nifty, but I still haven't actually played it. And 2 years later, I still haven't actually played it.
I took a look at it and I read it and I thought, I don't understand this. It is a system designed to model emotion and romance and making a total fool of yourself, which is, you know...
Some of us can do that but through natural talent.
Yeah, but this has role-playing mechanics for making a fool of yourself, I think. It doesn't have what is it that Robin Laws calls it? Stuff where you decide whether you can bust down the door or shoot the villain. It doesn't have
procedural.
Procedural, that's the word. It's all about the relationships.
I mean, being fair, in Pride and Prejudice, there isn't a whole lot of can I pick this lock.
Yeah. This is purely about romance and relationships. Roger is very big on romance, me not so much. But as I say, it looks like a worthy thing. It looks like an interesting thing. And with this offer this time, there's a lot of the twiddly bits that they did with it.
I did actually do a comparison because I still have what I downloaded last time. And I think the only file I did not already have is one specific setting.
Okay.
Though some of that may have been added, may have been something I got, but that wasn't in the earlier Kickstarter.
Some of the combinations look intriguing. I really must read the Magical School one, given what I'm running at the moment. But I feel some of them are a bit. A bit of the hybrid revisionist Austin, like Swords and Sorcery and Swordsmanship, and A Christmas Story About Vampires. I do feel that though that sort of thing is fun, it's not what the system was originally intended for, and it's not anything like what Jane Austen intended. Since Sensibility was originally taking a piss out of Gothic. Novels and that sort of imaginative.
As for Northanger Abbey,
was that Northanger Abbey?
Northanger Abbey is the true Gothic parody.
Oh right, it's been a long time since A Little. I'm terribly sorry.
What can I say? I'm still a big fan of Otranto, which includes the Knight of the Gigantic Saber. Brackets, not a euphemism.
Is not the Knight of not Otranto the Castle of Otranto the one which starts with a giant helmet falling out of the skies, which is never explained in any way.
That's correct.
Dear God.
But anyway, I agree with you. I mean, this is not designed for your actual Gothic, even your parody Gothic as a system. So while you could do it, it would be very much a weird procedural thing happened and is resolved in the background, and how do we feel about it is much more important. Now, that might well be a game I wanted to play, but I don't think it would be a game in which you wanted to give equal weight to both.
No. Maybe one day some kind person will come along to run a game of this for us.
Mm.
I don't think my enthusiasm... I also backed the first Kickstarter. I don't think my enthusiasm is going to go to the new one, but you may be different. We do this podcast for persons of diverse taste. So maybe your taste wants to divert onto this.
Yeah, if everybody liked the same stuff I like, then the stuff I like would be a lot more expensive.
If everybody liked the stuff you like, then it would bring the price down, Roger. You have training in economics. You should know this.
Yeah, but there's only so much economy of scale you can do when you're producing a PDF. Anyway, and people are greedy. Anyway, this is running until 16th of March.
So we do not feel guilty about giving you last-minute notifications in this particular case. So let's move onwards. This next section is probably going to get a bit abstruse. I was being driven home from my Wednesday night game by Graham. And Graham, in this game, as he does in just about every GURPS game I run, has luck for his character. And in the past, I have said that luck is a thing in the game universe. It is a thing that is detectable. My magic and my players are all playing magicians in a magical school. And Graham protested to me about this because he said he thought it was a bit weird. He was of the opinion that he didn't like the idea that characters in the game can know who is lucky and unlucky. He wanted a separation between the meta matters, the things that happen on the game system level, and the game universe as such. Now, I have gone fairly abstract in the past. I even had cause on another magical-based campaign to allow a spell which allowed people to detect how many character points they had, so that they would know whether giving themselves a new advantage magically would be dangerous for them and inclined to give them negative traits just to pay for the change, which I think may have been a mistake on my part. But I tend, on the whole, to say if something happens in the game system, it reflects something that happens in the game universe. And then I came across a posting contribution by our friend Pum. Hello, Pum, if you're listening, in the latest E&A. He was protesting against the idea that hit points and the bodily injuries you take are separate things. When you're fighting, this is to account for the fact that in D&D-ish games, you're not injured until you're not in any danger until your last hit point is gone.
Yeah, I remember people having the discussion in White Dwarf way back in the day. You know, they were suggesting that maybe hit points equal to your constitution is actual bodily injury, and anything higher than that is luck, divine favour, etc. That you can wear down without being seriously in danger.
And Pum's response goes like this. So let me get this straight. Hit points are basically luck points. Endurance represents the character's physical state. So if endurance is healed first, you could have a situation where the character feels perfectly fine, completely healed, but they're still weighed down in terms of hit stroke luck points. So how do you know whether or not they need another quaff of that healing potion? How do they know whether or not they need another quaff of the healing potion or another cure like wounds from the artist medic cleric? Which is an interesting point, but I think it's one that I can get around by saying I think characters in the game universe do say, I think I pushed my luck a little too far. I think some people have a feeling for when they're reaching the point where they really ought to stop. But is this...
For those is times, this a- there is cocaine.
Yes, you too can be overconfident and impotent.
I have a model which I think answers many of these questions.
Yeah.
But I don't think it applies to every game. It does tend to apply to the games I run, which is I start on the basis that there is a fictional reality, what Tolkien would have called a subcreation. There is a distinct separate world in which things are happening, you know, people are living.
Yeah,
happening, whatever.
It may only be a simulation run in our various games.
No, this is the point. It is a full-on world as far as the people in the world are concerned.
Yeah.
We may only be looking at a bit of it. However, we can observe it only through the clouded window of narration of the game mechanics.
Oh. I was going to say...
Hit points are not a real thing. Hit points are an abstracted representation of something that the characters know about, but we don't, which is basically how fighty they are feeling in an overall sense.
Yeah.
But we use hit points because it is a convenience that it is manageable for us at the table.
Yeah.
Similarly, you know, somebody in the world does not know I'm a level 7 fighter. They know I'm pretty good with a sword. I'm better than that guy, not as good as that guy.
Yeah.
As a result of that, I think what can be detected diegetically, in other words, by a character of another character as distinct from a player,
yeah,
very much depends on what it is in the world. And luck in GURPS terms, yeah, GURPS is a generic system, that luck can represent what a world would call a lot of different things.
Mm.
It might be that you have the favour of a god right now. Mm. And in that case, absolutely somebody could detect that you have the favour of a god. That is not a subtle thing, typically.
She's shining.
Or it might be that you have always just been a bit lucky and there is no particularly supernatural thing about it. It's just one of the rules of the world that some people can be like that, and maybe that's detectable, maybe it isn't.
I would say that whilst it might be real, the scientists in your modern day and future games are going to say, no, there's no such thing as luck. It's merely a statistical anomaly, and no amount of evidence will ever convince them otherwise.
And I have to say that I meet an essentially opposed attitude from some people, particularly people who play a lot of D&D or Pathfinder as their main games.
Yeah.
They do seem to have the approach that the game rules come first and what happens in the world is what can be modelled by the game rules. So they tend to be very caring about this class, not that class, is a thing that you can detect in the world, or this many hit points, or this level, or whatever else. That's not a system that works for me, but it does work for other people, so I'm not going to say that's wrong.
Well, I'm going to mention at this point the peculiar phenomenon of lit RPG, which tends to be a game in which somebody from an allegedly real world, like ours, finds themselves in a fantasy universe and finds that all those game mechanics that show up on the screen in a computer RPG, the skill trees, the messages saying that you have achieved level what's it, happen to them. Sometimes it's not clear whether that happens to everybody, but sometimes it is. And being on a path of learning a profession or gaining levels in a class is a real thing, and people talk about it. Doubt pub, and are willing to boast about their own abilities. And this, it seems to be the taking to the extreme, the attitude you've reported there. This is a very peculiar thing. I read a few of them some way in, but I keep wanting to know what's really going on, and the authors are, you know, pretty damn reluctant to get to the big reveal. I'm not sure they ever do. And after a while, the charms of it fade, and I give up on them.
I've read one of these which was not quite following that model. There was no suggestion that there was any world other than the one of the story, but people in it definitely had stats, which other people could look at in terms of, you know, their cybernetic upgrades and whatever.
Well, cybernetic upgrades would make sense.
Well, yeah, but they were done very much as you have this many slots free, and you get this upgrade and you get this many other slots, and you can improve your slot capacity by being more awesome and that kind of thing. Anyway, this...
I think I must have missed the lessons in being awesome that they gave out at school.
A thing that many people I know have experienced, and certainly this is true of me, is that, you know, one feels that all of a sudden everybody at school had the lesson on how to be a grown-up, and must have missed that day because I was ill or something.
Yeah, it's a common feeling. I've yet to hear from anybody who did have the lesson about being a grown-up, but maybe they're some of our... No, none of our listeners are going to turn out to be in that category.
But another thing that this comes into is alignment in your D&D-type games. As far as I'm concerned, the origin of game alignment is basically an army list. You are building an army for your game of chainmail.
Yep.
And the list says you can have orcs and ogres in the same army, but you can't have orcs and elves.
Yeah.
So you choose your army as a good army or an evil army. Fair enough. But
are you the Nazis this week?
But then you privilege that into the game setting and take it down to an individual scale, and you have things like your protection from good, no alignment. And at that point, as far as I'm concerned, it breaks the entire world, because all of a sudden, anybody with sufficient divine favour, but yeah, it is not a rare thing to be able to say, right, well, we can all agree... I and my enemies can all agree that that person is on this team, not that team.
And
from both, unless they do something very strange.
Yeah. Which is a totally different model from something like RuneQuest Glorantha, where it is detectable whether you are tainted with chaos or not by some people, and they're mostly drunks. It's a question of who you worship. Now, your race and your culture may bend you in one direction or the other, but people still choose to worship things that their culture does not normally worship. And sometimes their culture tolerates that, and sometimes they don't. There are humans who worship the gods of darkness, despite the fact that most of their worshippers are trolls. And their neighbours are suspicious of them. But if they're useful, and if they're not currently at war, then they'll put up with them. On the other hand, chaos is hated by everybody, even chaos.
Yeah, I've been listening recently to the Esoteric Order of Roleplayers podcast. They are going through the Company of the Dragon recent RuneQuest adventure campaign.
Yeah. I did the early part. It's very good.
And... one of the things that's happened in the most recent episode, I think, is very relevant. They are Praxian nomads. Probably somebody who understood it more than I would remember which specific sort. But basically, they are the culture we've generally been looking at in RuneQuest as the one PC has come from.
Hang on, though, that's Sartar.
Right. Anyway, the Lunars are coming.
Yep.
The Lunars are invading. The Lunars are the bad guys, clearly. But there isn't, you know, that they would probably think of themselves as being good and the Lunars as being evil. But there is no absolute standard on this. And so when they talk to the nearby Eldri army, with whom their people have their own beefs, they cannot simply say, well, we're good and you're good, you must fight with us against this evil.
Yeah.
They have to make real arguments like, yeah, once they've steamrolled us, they're going to come for you next.
Yeah, you're wrong in the setting. They're actually Sartorites stuck up in a high mountain valley.
Okay, thank you.
I ran the first part of it, 6 seasons in Sartar, and that bit is very good. I really have a great temptation to go back to it someday. But yeah, the thing that came out in the 6 seasons of Sartar that I played is the Lunars are mostly criticised for being an arrogant imperial power, determined on crushing. Now, the fact that they tolerate chaos and they have some chaos forces working for them is the primary sin that they're judged for, but it's the petty things like raising the taxes and denying the right of the clan chief to wield justice. The sort of things that the Normans are doing to the Saxons in extremist versions of Robin Hood stories. That's what they're practically judged on. And yeah, it's not about... There's more than one side. But I think alignment is a specialised case.
Yeah, but it's another example of, here is a thing that is clearly a game, as far as I'm concerned at least, clearly invented to be a game convenience, that then becomes privileged into the game and causes huge distortions there.
And it means that the pantheons of that sort of game look very odd indeed.
Yeah.
But all right, so what do I say to my...
My answer is it involves more work for the GM. But basically, you need to decide for any given trait that someone has, is this a thing that is detectable in the world? Is this a thing that... Is it the divine favour? Or is it maybe something like combat reflexes, where it's pretty obvious unless someone is trying to hide it, because they are just that little bit more alert than normal people? But there is no spell that says, do you have combat reflexes?
Well, I think I distinguish between things of the body, things of the mind, and things of the soul. Magic is a thing that's tied to the soul. Combat reflexes is a combination of body and mind. It's a thing you can learn in many GURPS. But in many versions of GURPS, you get trained by somebody, and there's trained by a master, which is mostly a thing of the mind and body, but might affect the soul sometimes. So that's my model, but it doesn't really help me because there are things, aura spells, which can tell you things about a person's soul. And there are things like telepathy, which can reach the mind.
They are things like, is this person undead, or is this person currently possessed, or in the grip of a strong emotion? It's that sort of thing that aura tells you. It's a very useful list, in fact. It does not say things like, how many points do they have?
Well, no. How many?
You can play GURPS as very meta. There are some variant rules, for example, where you can spend points either before or after the die roll to improve the result. But I cannot see that as the character saying, I'm going to spend a point. I can see that as the character thinking, I'm going to try extra hard on this.
Yeah,
using that resource of extra hard concentration, which they clearly cannot deploy all the time.
Yeah, there's a mechanic in Call of Cthulhu, modern Call of Cthulhu anyway, in which you're allowed to push your luck.
Mm.
You fail that vital roll. You get to try again, perhaps, at a halved percentage.
There are two separate things here.
Yeah.
The one that is normally available, this is all in Call of Cthulhu 7th edition, by the way.
That's what I was thinking.
Not in previous versions. So the standard one that is available in most games is that if you miss the roll, you can spend points of luck on a one-for-one. Your luck is on a percentage scale. It's five. Okay, these days it's basically like your power. But you can spend that to change the die result to bring it down to what you needed.
Yeah, but that's not what I was talking about.
Okay, so the separate thing is it pushing your luck? I think they call it something else. But in any case, you get a second roll. It's at the same percentage, but if you fail a second time, then something bad will happen. They don't actually treat it as a fumble. It's usually considered a negative external consequence.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. And the...
That's normally only in pulp mode, I should say.
Okay, I think that is not something that the player can... I mean, the character can perceive. The player can think, oh, I failed. No, I'm going to risk it. But two, that from the point of view of the character, it's just I've nearly failed, I'm going to try really hard here, oh dear, I've just fallen in the reservoir. From the character's point of view, he doesn't know that meta bargain that is being made. I'll try again in return for risking something bad if I fail again. And I think that's not the sort of thing.
Pushing the roll, that's what they call it.
Pushing the roll. Okay. I don't think that's something that a character can know. Likewise, I don't think the character in a GURPS game ever knows, oh, I failed, I've got two more tries when he's lucky. But I think people might observe the effects of it, and the effects of it might be visible. I can see it upsets...
What I think it looks like in the world when you do that is you almost screw up and then you somehow salvage it.
Sometimes it turns into critical. Oh, there, I was wrong. I did it all along. I meant to do that, I think is the expression. actually, what goes around my table, given that luck is so common, is somebody says, I think I'm luckier than that. I can see why people are objecting to it. I don't think all game universes have a paradigm which would allow for admitting of the existence of such things as luck.
Well, the one that troubles me more in GURPS, I think, is intuition, which is essentially you have a slightly improved chance of randomly picking the right answer to something.
Yeah, I never thought that intuition really worked, because the GM has to be able to come up with a definitive number of possible things it could be, and that's just not how my brain works, nor any universe that I have been exposed to works. There's always one more thing it might be. But yeah, intuition doesn't quite work for me. And none of my players take common sense, even the ones who need it.
The ones who need it are the ones who are always least prepared to do it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, consider also Weirdness Magnet, which I incline to ban simply because it's really hard work for the GM.
True, but it's a great opportunity for the GM. Oh, I wonder if Weirdness Magnet would be detectable by... maybe.
Well, this comes back to my original point, which is... where did it come from? Why has the character got it? And that's the question I think you need to answer. Again, you have Weirdness Magnet because the god of fiddly little details got really annoyed with you and cursed you. Absolutely, yeah. That's detectable. Any priest can say, oh boy, you're under curse, get out of my temple. But what they're detecting is the curse, it's not the Weirdness Magnet.
I think, I can think of deities who might regard Weirdness Magnet as a blessing. I've just blessed your child.
Yeah, stay even further away from them.
All right, this is another thing. I'm not sure I'm willing not to do things in order to... All right, to a certain point, I'm willing to abstain from things which are upsetting my players' sense of realism. But I am not at all sure... This sort of thing goes very deep into the metaphysics of a setting with magic and active deities, which is the one that my current campaign is in, and many, maybe even most of my games are in. But I take your point. You have to look at the roots of it and why it's there.
What I'm seeing as an overall model here is that the character, the actual character in the universe, as opposed to the numbers on the sheet over here, has this thing which, as it might be, favoured or cursed by a particular god. And that is a thing that they can detect in the world, because that's the thing they talk about, you know. Oh, I lost at dice last night. I must have annoyed the god of luck.
Excuse me, no, people talk about that, but it doesn't. What people talk about doesn't necessarily exist.
Yeah, but it might. It's a thing they believe exists. It wouldn't break their worldview if it actually did.
My player, Martin, believes he's cursed with bad dice luck. I don't know. Despite all the evidence, I'm not yet.
Every group has one.
Yeah.
But then through that clouded window, their package of divine favour or disfavour comes out onto the character sheet as maybe luck and maybe a specialised aura and maybe something else.
Hmm.
And nobody can detect those, because those aren't things that exist in the world.
Maybe they do. I think that's what I was... I mean, I once came to the conclusion that character points with spare character points were a thing that could be detected in the world. I'm not sure if I was inspired or crazy when I came up with that, but it was something that was necessary to allow the players not to be afraid to allow the characters be brave enough to do what the players wanted to do.
Well, all right, that's not the model I would tend to use. If it works for you, then fair enough.
I told you this was going to get abstruse. All right, we've been abstruse enough. Let's go on for something incredibly concrete and realistic next. Hey. What is next?
Something that has been on my mind a little recently, because it's something that I regard as a bit old-fashioned, but it shows up in even quite modern adventures, is the random encounter.
Yeah.
And specifically, this is, it's not related to the plot. It is, as it might be, you're an alien world and you get a random animal attack, if the dice say you do, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Back in the very early days of this podcast, we talked to Mike Monard.
Oh, yeah.
He seemed to be pretty clear that the original wandering monsters were essentially a tax on the party standing around and faffing rather than getting on with the thing.
I think they are hurry up music. Yeah, you know, melodramas used to have music in the background. They were called music dramas. That's why. And dun 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 would play when it was time for the action to move along. And I think that they are indeed hurry. They're also a reality simulator. If you're down in the bowels of the Nazi-occupied castle, there ought to be a chance that some random corporal comes down the corridor at you and spots you. Or even a corporal with a squad of men come down to clean out the latrines.
I think the specific point about the original dungeon ones is that they canonically do not have treasure. And that's why I say they're explicitly designed as a tax rather than as an extra adventuring opportunity.
Well, the corporal and his squad only have buckets and spades, but...
Yeah, but they might also have useful passes that you can use to get elsewhere in the base.
And information, if you talk to them.
Yeah, so that's where I see it starting. I think they're more interesting if they provide flavour.
Yeah.
There is rustling in the grass, and eventually that rustling in the grass will become something leaps out at you and tries to eat your head.
Yeah, look, give them... if you can stretch it out, you can give them several rustles in the grass before one of them gets his head eaten.
That was actually something I'm pretty sure I didn't invent this, though. I haven't seen it elsewhere, but it's what I call the progressive random encounter. So this is particularly for the sort of party that's hanging around in a particular area for a fairly extended period.
Yeah.
You know, we are exploring this particular block of hexes or whatever. And essentially, each entry on the encounter table is a mini story. So yeah. The first time that particular line comes up, you see an old campsite. It's been abandoned. Mm. Doesn't tell you anything particularly interesting. The second time you see a dead peasant, or possibly several dead peasants, and their cottage has been burned. The third time, maybe you see a group of suspiciously well-fed and well-armed men in this area where there isn't supposed to be anybody.
Yeah.
You gradually develop, yes, there is an armed marauding group out here taking what they can by... And you could do similar things with animals, monsters, whatever else.
Yeah, Yeah,
and that's the thing I find interesting, because it means you can have these multiple overlapping narratives. It doesn't really matter what order the distinct stories happen in, but within an individual story, you have this defined order of escalation.
It doesn't matter whether they see the footprints of the dinosaurs first, or the smouldering remains of somebody's camp, but each of those has a progression going forward.
Yeah. And that's the approach I tend to use. The other thing that occurs to me as flavour, which is, you know, say you have your standard people you meet in a city table, yeah. But you then tweak it a bit, and then in this city, we seem to be running into guards a lot of the time. I mean, they're being perfectly friendly and so on, but just seeing a whole lot more of them than usual. I wonder what that is. And this is obviously easier if you have the ability to generate tables and tweak the numbers a bit. But let's face it, we do these days. So.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for a deck of random cards, of index cards with things scribbled on them. That actually, I must get back to the to keeping a box of index cards for each game, because my memory is getting worse and I need to keep things that I can update the character on at the time and not at the end of the session.
Fair. I would say as a note form, that's great. If you're planning to shuffle them, then it makes the probabilities very blunt, because you can have one card in the deck or two cards in the deck, but you can't have one and a half.
Well, you can have you can have a card with the complete path of encounters on it to be struck off
absolutely
as you go, and I think
is the thing I was just saying. You know, in this particular city, there are a lot of these and fewer of those, as easily with that, which you can with the table.
True. Okay. I think this applies to sandbox games primarily. Mm. If you've got a path to be on, then everything you encounter should be at the proper planned place, or at least each node on the tree of clues that you have offered to you should have its own thing to be there, thing to be discovered, person to be encountered. But then I think what happens then is there are two sorts of encounter. There's the encounter ahead of you, which is trying to stop you getting to the truth. And there's the encounter behind you, which is the authorities, who are trying to find out what it is that you've been up to all this time.
I remember Traveller talking about the push and the pull. You know, the push is those guys back at the last planet. They really don't want us back, and if we go back there, they will do bad things.
Yeah.
Whereas the pull is, I've heard that we can make lots of money over there.
Yeah, in Traveller, the pull is primarily financial. If you've got your own starship, it's got to be fueled. It's got to be maintained. You've got to buy fresh Pop-Tarts to see you through the long interstellar years. I'm sorry, I had a burst of poetry there. Oh dear, the thought of scouts living on nothing but Pop-Tarts energy drinks as they wander between the way stations or the postal service.
We got great sponsorship from Imperial Food Co.
Oh, that would account for it, yeah.
And obviously, that's the advertising. Dave the Scout did a 3-year mission entirely on Pop-Tarts and Red Bull. Say hello, Dave.
I was picturing something slightly more weedy. Hello. Okay. There is something to be said for random encounters, especially in when they're just wandering from place to place. You need something that will give you inspiration. Let's be frank here. The GM will also turn to the random encounter mechanics when they haven't got the foggiest idea what they're going to do next, and they need something to get the players interested again.
At that point, I think it's also helpful to have a reason for that monster, that person, whatever, to be there.
Yeah,
which is not well worth putting in advance if it's a fixed thing. You know, if this particular monster is out prowling, it is because it is looking for food, for example. Not hard to work out. Where this one is off foraging and it'll probably run away rather than attack you. These guys are explicitly on a patrol and they're looking for people who do not belong, brackets PCs.
Yep.
That sort of thing. And obviously you can do the rolled reaction and so on as well, but for me at least it's always very helpful to say, why are these whatevers here?
Yeah. I mean, I have created out of thin air numerous encounters with people and officials who want to know what's going on here. Yesterday evening, it was the sewer worker who was asking why the hell these apprentice magicians are going down into his sewers, and did they mean to leave that manhole cover off there? Don't they know that's a crime?
Which I had. There are rules about warning signs.
The players said that they thought there ought to be warning signs, and he said, "What on every bloody manhole cover in the bloody city?" Which I think was a reasonable retort. Honestly, I should have argued with them more about going down into the sewers and risking life and limb, but it did actually move the story forward. So I let them get away with it. And I even let them get away with casting clean spells on each other so that they could come out without any harm to their nice new apprentices' uniforms.
All sorts of fatal and disgusting things can happen in sewers, especially if nobody involved is a minor, and therefore they don't know the warning signs of flammable gas.
Ooh. Is that very likely?
Yes.
All right.
You get airlocks. In
All right. I may pay no attention, my listeners, my regulars, but I may have discovered what's going to happen when you go back down. Right.
I point out that the Davy safety lamp is invented really quite late in this process.
Well, unfortunately, the city they're in has at least Victorian levels of technology, and in places 20th to 21st century technology. But on the other hand, I don't think any of them have thought about Davy lamps. Okay.
What can I say? The last sewer-related adventure I ran was Warhammer, so...
Oh, dear. Well, that's deliberately disgusting.
Yes.
I hope that they may actually try and get some waders before going down there again. But this is one of the points where the players look at me and say, "You're being unfair." Yeah, no, that wouldn't really happen. We've got that covered with magic, and I so want to drop them deep into it. And I have the opportunity in this case.
You cast the clean spell. The spirit manifests. It shrugs its shoulders at you and says, "You're asking for a written miracle, mate."
Fortunately, this is not spirit-based magic. I think we've wandered off the point. I think random encounters are a good thing. I'm not energetic enough to provide them, I think. But I can come up with stuff when I think it's appropriate. And I think I should... I think the players should always be expecting an unpleasant surprise to come around the corner. Occasionally, you give them a pleasant surprise. Mostly, it's going to be an unpleasant surprise just when they thought they were safe. I think that's what you were trying to...
Well, that's another thing. I don't think it has to be random.
Okay.
The crudity of every 10 minutes in the dungeon we will roll and on a six a monster appears.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can get more sophisticated than that. You are sitting down having a discussion in this corridor. Well, yeah, that's going to make some noise. Somebody's going to come and find out and look to see what it is and whether you taste good.
Mm. The general social mechanic is heat in the Forge and the Dark games. The stuff you did before causes consequences to the things you have to do later. You've drawn attention to yourself. The authorities know there's someone out there. They might not know it's you, but they know there's someone out there.
Yeah, and this can certainly work on a smaller scale as well. Kicking down a door makes a lot of noise.
Yeah, this is why you've got the thief along, isn't it?
Mm. But, you know, all of these things, having a fight definitely makes a lot of noise. Armour is really noisy.
Well, all bits of metal are noisy if you bang them together.
Yeah, so all these things. I've been looking at a thing recently in which essentially there are various types of terrain in reasonably close proximity, and what the adventure gives me is, in this sort of terrain, this is the predominant sort of thing that might attack the PCs, and here is the circumstance in which it will do so.
Well, that
seems perfectly reasonable to me. And whether it actually happens at a specific time, that can be randomised. But I don't need a great big table for this. Or even six different ones for the different terrain types.
Yeah, I think... all right, we appreciate this in people who write scenarios. Please, people who write scenarios, give this some thought. I am too lazy to do anything as prepared as this. But it makes city environments. I'm really looking forward to what Robin Laws and Kaosim have done with Parvis for the new era. Sitting encounters and things happening. The feel of the place is what encounters give you. Whether they are civilized persons or ravening monsters.
Well, okay, I'm going to go slightly off topic again here. Part of the problem with D&D acting as it was, as an attractor for all sorts of different fantasy things, and the idea is you can put them all in the same game.
And they have.
Is that if you're not quite careful, it can tend to be quite flavourless because all the things are here, and you go to the next city and all the things are here.
Yeah.
And I do think it is genuinely more interesting if the next city is not just a palette swap away, but it has a different flavour of things. People do things in different ways, particularly in a setting where communication is relatively slow and expensive and rare compared with what the PCs do. That should be a thing that happens, and it's fun.
Yeah, you speak to my other current campaign, which is again a bunch of lictors working for an imperial magistrate, going ahead of the court to investigate the cases that are coming up. And I try to make each location slightly different. I'm not entirely sure that it's as different in the players' minds as it sometimes is in mine. When the people they interact with are very different, a mad dowager countess in one place and a very unassertive archbishop in another, then they get then they can build it up. But I do wish I had more ability to easily create maps of places that will be convincing and suitable for that particular place.
Yeah, I think Traveller's good for this as well. You have what you might call a standard interface, say, assuming you're operating in the Imperium, then there are certain expectations that will be met of any world in the Imperium. If they have a starport of this class, you can land your ship there and do stuff and so on, and it will work basically the same way. But the moment you cross that fence, it's anybody's game.
Yeah.
And obviously the GM will find a reason why you have to cross that fence. Brett Evel's Flat Black takes the planetary romance idea to extremes, and in that, essentially, the spacecraft are not really within control of the player characters. What they have is, your mission is to go to this planet and achieve thing.
Yeah. I was thinking about Space 1999. I think I mentioned it in ENA this month. Space 1999, and the fact it didn't make any sense whatsoever, and the fact you could have written something about the moon careening across the galaxy, which would have made some sort of sense, but
part of the problem is that they had this really interesting high concept, and then even in the first season, but also especially in the second season, they just told generic Planet of the Week story.
Yeah, I don't object to Planet of the Week nor Monster.
Yeah, but it doesn't fit this concept.
Yeah.
It fits Star Trek reasonably well.
Yeah, well, because they have a mission, and they're sent by people to go and do things. Sometimes they find things they weren't expecting. But, yeah, Space 1999, I came to the conclusion that this is a bad review. You may ignore it if you don't want to, but I found that the system not particularly suited to anything. I found the adventure we were given a mess, and I find the idea overall as being something not worth recreating. I mean, it looked good. It had some good actors, not in the lead roles, but it had some good actors. But
you're thinking of Barry Morse, aren't you?
I'm thinking of Barry Morse, yeah. He was good. but the whole thing as a whole was just a mess. Somebody saying, let's do a science fiction again. And it didn't make any sense.
Well, you're aware of the genesis of this.
It was supposed to be UFO season 2.
Yeah, and at one point during the development, they're having the high concept meeting. Let's blow up the Earth. Jerry, the viewers might get nervous about that. Okay, let's blow up the moon.
Honestly, the survivors of the Earth fleeing the aliens who were the enemy in the first thing, I would have gone with the time travel high concept, because it's clear that the aliens coming along to steal spare parts out of humans are, you know, humans. They have to be. So maybe humans from the far polluted future. I think that was considered at one point.
Yeah.
All right. We've run to the end of this?
I think so.
That was Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, and we hope to be back in another month. If you want to send us your comments, you can reach us via...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.li.
And speaking of the website, maybe next month Roger will reveal what he meant on the website tekeli.li when he declared that he was a wizard. I want to know. The world deserves to know.